Pavel Pawlikowski, the director and writer of Cold War, and you're listening to Filmwax Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. It is Thursday, June 27th, 2019. This is episode 562 of the podcast. This is a conversation I recently had with the film historian Josephine McBride. He had recently written a book, a biography of the filmmaker Ernst Lubitsch, who's like from the golden age of Hollywood. Lubitsch has directed such classics as To Be or Not to Be, Trouble in Paradise, Ninotchka, Shop Around the Corner, and Design for Living. I mean, just those five films alone. And yet he's directed far more than that. But Joseph McBride, in this conversation, not only do we talk about Ernst Lubitsch, but we talk about so many other people like Orson Welles and all these people whose lives that Joseph McBride has touched over the years. He arrived on the scene when all the still the great directors from the old Hollywood system were still alive, or at least most of them. And he has met Hitchcock and Orson Welles and so many of the other great filmmakers, so including John Ford, possibly most notably. We're going to have another episode with Joe at some point, which has already been recorded and is actually already on the YouTube channel, but I want to put it on, make sure it's also on the podcast. But we talk in great length about John Ford, the complex man that he is, which is another book that Joe had written some time ago. And we're also in the discussion of we're also discussing bringing Joe back on again, so I would have him on all the time. He's one of the most fascinating, brilliant people, and he can talk. This is Joseph McBride here on Filmwax Radio. Okay, alrighty. I'm being directed by Joseph McBride. It's an honor. Okay, so hello. How are you, Joe?
Hi, good to talk to you.
Same here. I'm so pleased. You know, I think I started the John Ford book a while ago. I had to put it down. On some level, it's very, of course, intimidating because it's such an enormous tome. Then I got all caught up with Other Side of the Wind, and I discovered you, and I knew about you as an author. But then I went back to the book, John, and I said, oh my God, this is you. I just put it all made connections in my head finally. So that's when I said, let me look this guy up and see if I can invite you on. So thank
you. Oh, well, thank you so much. It's great to draw those connections. Certain great directors who I've been studying for a long time. I mean, Welles thought Ford was the greatest director of all, too, you know, for example. So these things tie together in certain ways.
Yeah, and you are part of a group of folks who just have a profound love and respect for those particular directors, John Ford, Howard Hawks, Orson Welles, Hitchcock, of course, and not to leave out Ernst Lubitsch, who I want to talk at length with you later on, but this is the new book. It came out in June of 2018, and I'm glad we're finally getting around to talk about it, because it's very much available anywhere books are sold. It's called How Did Lubitsch Do It? We've heard of this something called the Lubitsch Touch, and this book explains it at a great length about what that was that made him so unique, and why so many, like so many of his peers, really looked to him, didn't they?
Yeah, David Niven, who excuse me, was one of his actors, and I got to know David Niven, who's a great wit, good writer too. He called him the master's master, which I think is a nice description, because almost all the directors of that generation looked up to Lubitsch as the best or one of the best. And go down the list of Ford, Capra, Renoir, just all the top directors back then, Hawks, etc. Mm-hmm. They imitated him and they learned from him. He was Ford made a great comment that he said something to the effect that we all thought we were just making entertainment. Lubitsch was the only one of us who realized we were making art, which is quite a compliment. I think Ford, knew he was making art too, but it was a tribute to Lubitsch's great craftsmanship and artistry. It was so beautiful. They all aspired to it. And his originality, Wells mentioned that. He said he was, there's a wonderful quote from Wells. Wells said Lubitsch was a giant. He said Lubitsch's talent and originality are stupefying. And Jean Renoir said that Lubitsch invented the modern Hollywood. Quite remarkable tributes. And, Wells talking about his originality, I think, hit on something that, I tried, as you said, to define the Lubitsch touch in this book that's more than 500 pages long, and that shows you how difficult it is to define it, because it's an evanescent term, or another word that Andrew Saras used about Lubitsch's style was ineffable. And when I was talking to Jim Naramore, a good scholar, he and I were talking about Lubitsch a few years ago, and he said, well, it's really hard to write about him because he's ineffable, isn't he? And I thought about that a lot, and it's hard to put your finger on the style, but that's part of what the point of the style is. It's a subtlety, and it's not something that's obvious by definition. It's avoiding the cliché, as Truffaut put it, another great admirer of Lubitsch. He said Lubitsch would do anything possible to avoid the cliché, and he would rack his brain. He said he bled himself white and died 20 years too early because he was racking his brain to think of ways to tell stories in an original way. And he would say to, Lubitsch would say to his favorite screenwriter, Samson Raphaelson, in his German accent, he'd say, how did he do it without, how did he say this without saying that? In other words, let's get a point across, but not do it the obvious way. And they would always look for a different angle, different approach, a different oblique method. Obliqueness is the key to his method. They would show people reacting to something instead of showing the thing actually happening. Part of it was the response to censorship, because in those days there were certain things you could not show. But being a subtle guy, he wouldn't have wanted to show people rolling around in bed anyway. I mean, that's not all that dramatically interesting. So what's more interesting is what goes on in your mind when you see the closed door. Door shots were big part of his style, and it makes you think and makes you participate in the film, and
makes the audience lean in as they will often. Yeah, because when you described him as you were paraphrasing one of the great directors about calling him the first great modern director. Was that Wells?
I don't remember that quote exactly, but Renoir said he invented the modern Hollywood.
Okay. Was that because of the sexual undertone often, or he tried to, as you said, cleverly conceal it, I guess, and make it very difficult for the censors to know what to do, right?
Yeah, one of the censors said, I think this is kind of a key to Lubitsch's art, he said, we know what he's saying, but we don't know how he's saying
yeah,
it,
I love
so
that.
We can't cut it. And that was part of the reason he did it that way, so he couldn't be cut, although he did have a few run-ins with censors, but they actually, they were smart enough to admire his cunning and cleverness in getting around censorship, and but he got away with some pretty remarkable things. Designed for Living is a kind of a mind-blowing film today. It's about a menage a trois, and it's very obvious that, three people are together, and at the end of the film, they're all together in one shot, and riding off into the night together, and it makes no bones about it, and Molly Haskell said it, that kind of demolishes every canon of respectability, even bohemian respectability. And so he was, he would do clever things that would play games with the censors, and the audience was complicit in this. They kind of knew the rules. Mm-hmm. And, okay, let's see how much you can say without hitting people over the head with it. And, for example, the opening of Trouble Trouble in Paradise, which is my favorite Lubitsch film. I think it's the perfect romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. He and Rafelson spent 3 days trying to think of the opening, and it's a romantic film taking place in Venice, and so the cliche is to start with a beautiful shot of the Grand Canal and gondola going through the canal. Instead, he started with a garbage can and a dog, and it looks very grubby. It could be anywhere. And then the heavyset garbage man comes in and lifts out the can, and then he walks, the camera pans over to the canal, and you see the canal then, and he dumps the garbage into a gondola, a garbage gondola, and then you see the whole canal, a long shot with a beautiful
the Grand Canal.
You know, it's not the usual way of starting with the long shot and going, you know, it's starting with the detail and then gradually revealing the setting. I notice he does that a lot in different ways. If a film takes place in a castle, he doesn't usually start the film with a long shot of the castle and move in like most directors do. He will start with some detail or some other scene and then gradually show you the surroundings. And but that was more fun and more clever. And it makes a point because he's undercutting romance and sort of mucking conventional ideas of romance and Trouble in Paradise and by showing garbage. And then he cuts back to it at a certain point in the middle of a love scene. He cuts back to the garbage gondola going down the canal with the garbage man is singing Solo Mio, you know,
right.
Which is kind of a cliche, but it means Oh My Sunshine, which is ironic because it's at night. So it's really clever, but it took him 3 days to think of that opening.
Which, you know, we take sort of for granted, but at the time especially, nobody knew how to wrap their mind around that. That was just confusing and yet compelling, right, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, he was groundbreaking. I think what Renoir had in mind partly was, when Lubitsch came to America in 1922 from Germany, where he was the leading director in Germany, he's probably the only director who's been the leading director in two different countries.
Right.
American films were still pretty Victorian. It was the early 20s. D.W. Griffiths was still going strong, and he was mm-hmm. the great director of the early period. And he had a Victorian sensibility about sexuality, among other things. And Lubitsch comes along with a very cosmopolitan European viewpoint and treated sex in a much more adult fashion. And that's partly why they brought him to Hollywood. He had made Madame Du Barry about the French Revolution, which is a very racy film. And Hollywood thought, oh, the guy can make a big epic, you know, spectacle, but with a kind of a modern sexual sensibility. And, you know, after World War One, when people were disillusioned by the war and everything was changing and women were getting liberated and getting to vote, and people's sexual mores were loosening up and their attitudes were loosening, and Lubitsch came along right at that point, and he showed Hollywood the way of how to deal with sex in an adult way and be funny about it.
Well, it was he was living in Berlin, right? That's where he was based, in Germany.
Yeah,
and he was that during Weimar Germany? Was it Weimar Germany?
Yeah, the Weimar period World War One, which went till Hitler took over in 1933.
Right.
But Lubitsch, as Billy Wilder, who was one of his top acolytes, said, he kind of joked, a dark joke. He said he was one of the talented ones who was brought over instead of having to flee, like Wilder himself had to flee.
Right.
Many hundreds of people came over as refugees and enriched Hollywood with their talents. But Lubitsch was at the forefront because they brought him over, and they were trying to, as Hollywood often does, you know, buy off another film industry. And kind of, they brought Murnau over soon after that, and Fritz Lang came over. But Lubitsch had the longest and most successful career of the German imports.
That's ironic, considering he died in his mid-50s in 1947?
47,
yeah.
Quite a long time ago, and before, one reason he was sort of neglected, and, you know, that's one reason I wrote the book, was, he wasn't around to give interviews like a lot of the old directors were, and when I came to Hollywood in the 70s, I made it my business to interview everybody I admired, and
that's
most
amazing.
Of them were around, you know.
I was going to say, this is maybe your first biography that where you didn't meet your subject,
that's true. Of the three that I've done, Ford, Spielberg and Capra, I met them. Spielberg I met only twice, but I met him when he was 27. They were doing a press thing in the commissary at Universal for Jaws, and I spent an hour sitting at a table listening to him talk with some other journalists about Jaws.
It was a round table,
and
yeah.
So I got to meet him. Yeah, it was less formal than they do now. It was just kind of casual. And then I met him briefly at a party once and talked to him, but he wouldn't give me an interview because he says he's saving it for his autobiography. But in other ways, he was actually helpful because he encouraged other people to talk to me. People would call his office and say, should I talk to McBride? And they were told I was kosher, which I thought was nice. You know? The only person he told his mother not to talk to me, and she was very nice, and she was very apologetic. And I said, who told you not to talk to me? And she said, the gods. And obviously, Stephen, but, you know, your mother knows all the really bad stories about you, you know, what's under your bed, and he had a parakeet fly around his bedroom and take dumps on the bedroom and stuff, and, you know.
Yeah, but in most cases, the mom is also the most fiercely protective of their son, especially the Jewish mothers. I had one, and she was...
Well, I'm sure she would... Well, she was a character because she was very free in her... talk. She became a sort of a celebrity because of him, and she would be on talk shows. I saw her on The Tonight Show once making jokes with Johnny Carson. She had a great personality, and so there were a lot of interviews with Leah Spielberg, so I was able to quote from them, which was fine. And the person who had not been interviewed much was his father. Actually, I wasn't aware of any interviews with his father, so I got to meet him. I guess before Stephen knew that I was talking to him, I just contacted him, and he said, sure, and we had a great interview. He was really, he's a very interesting guy. He's still alive. He's 102.
He's still alive.
Yeah, Mrs. Spielberg died a little while ago, but Arnold is still around and still in good shape.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that. I know, I think he was in...
talk to the father of the guy.
I think he was in the, was he in that recent documentary?
Well,
the recent Spielberg documentary for...
Recently, but I don't remember,
on American Masters.
In there, but
yeah.
He was on a TV show with he and his wife were on talking about their marriage and revealing some things about their marriage with to Stephen. And pretty much I had that story already in my book. Got it from other sources. But he kind of misunderstood the circumstances of his parents' divorce, which marked him, of course. We see that throughout his films.
Sure, especially the early ones.
But he kind of blamed his father and... unfairly, and I brought that point out. And his father was an amateur filmmaker before Stephen came along, and Stephen kind of took over the family hobby, and his father worked with him. And so he, you know, I think through the book and other things, he came to appreciate his father more, which I feel good about.
Oh, that's great that you could contribute something like that. Very rewarding, I imagine, right? You
know? Yeah, it was a good feeling, and I'd heard that from a lot of people, that Mr. Spielberg was a great guy, and he was, you know, like one of the kids, I interviewed all the kids who were in Steven's amateur films, which nobody had ever written about. It's a great story. And the guy said, well, you know, I really didn't know who was directing, Mr. Spielberg or Steven. You know, I could never really tell. So it was kind of a father-son hobby for a while until Steven became the dominant figure, which was interesting.
Are you talking about, like, Amblin days?
This is before that. Amblin, he'd been directing for 11 years before that. He was 21 when he made Amblin. He started when he was 10. And Billy Wilder had a great line. He said Steven Spielberg was a great director when he was 10 years old, and he actually was.
You could see an early vision, in other words, maybe, that was very, very rare for a kid, let alone a young filmmaker.
Well, just the technical experimentation and all the different styles and genres he tried. And like one of the kids showed up at, they were told to go to the local airport that Stephen was shooting a film. And he was just amazed that Stephen had somehow procured an airliner to be in his film. And they were filming on the runway. And another time he said, we went out to shoot a war movie in the mountains. And Stephen came along in his mother's Jeep with a machine gun. A real machine gun, and he said everybody else was saying, geez, he has a Jeep, and I thought, well, this kid has a machine gun. Where did this kid get this machine gun? Yeah.
Did that come up in 1941? Where was it?
Well, no, not really.
I can't remember. I thought that sounds familiar, like that scenario or version of that popped up in one of
there's that film, what's it called, Super 8, I believe, that he produced that some other filmmakers said there was kind of a takeoff on filmmakers. It kind of was a homage to Stephen, I think, as a young filmmaker.
Definitely was. But I just remember, I thought there was a scene where, is it 1941 is the one about the town one of his early movies. It's a comedy, but it's about this whole town that's getting ready for an attack, and an American town. And they I think they think there's like the war's coming to America or something like that.
Well, it's set in Los Angeles, so it's making fun of Los Angeles, and it's based very loosely on a real event where they thought there was a Japanese attack taking place, but it was
a
bunch of a false alarm, and some anti-aircraft guns went off, and actually five people died, partly because of this incident. And the Japanese actually shelled a pier in Santa Barbara. A Japanese submarine lobbed a couple shells and destroyed a pier. That's as close as they got to the American mainland. But it caused this hysteria in Los Angeles. It's too bad. You know, the real story is better than the fanciful stuff that they did. 1941 is kind of a huge mess and disaster, but very interestingly filmed. But they leave out so much that's important, and they throw in things that are absurd. But I don't remember if there's anything specifically about kids going around with machine guns. But
I could just be inventing that, so we can disregard it. But
it sounds like a good scene.
Yeah, I might remake it and add that. I don't know. It's a
that could be funny. Go ahead and say you're going to remake 1941. See what they say.
Yeah. that of all of his films. So you obviously got to know. Well, at least when you met Spielberg, you met John Ford, which we're going to come back to, of course. And by the way, Ernst Lubitsch left such a mark, and he died so young, but it seemed like his mark was left more on the industry than, let's say, on moviegoers. I mean, what's wonderful is you're hopefully introducing, as maybe the Turner Classic Movie Channel has, Ernst Lubitsch to a larger audience, potentially, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, because he just never had maybe it's just the sheer amount of years. I don't know.
Well, back in his day, he was almost a household name as much as any director was. There wasn't as much awareness, but there were a few people like, say, Hitchcock and Capra, whose names became pretty well known to the public. And it partly had to do with how good a self-publicist you were, and those two guys were great at that. But Lubitsch was known to the public. His name was sort of a brand, and they kind of knew that it stood for sophisticated comedy, and he really created
the
romantic
Noel
comedy
Coward.
Genre.
Yeah, okay.
Claudette Colbert, who I interviewed, said that before it happened one night, the Capra made in 1934, they called it high comedy. They didn't call it romantic comedy. That term wasn't being used that much, but Lubitsch created the earliest examples of what we now consider the romantic comedy in its classic form. There was a film called The Marriage Circle in 1924, which is a wonderful silent film, extremely sophisticated story of a couple and their marital problems, and very funny, and it was tremendously influential on all kinds of directors. Hitchcock and Douglas Sirk and other directors said they learned so much. Michael Powell said he got into the industry because of that film, and yeah, he had a tremendous effect on other directors, but the public knew who Lubitsch was, and they loved his films. And he also helped create the musical. Before him, musicals were pretty much reviews where people would sing and dance on the stage, and then there'd be a story going on. But he integrated song and dance and music in The Love Parade in 1929. He wasn't the only one. There was King Vidor did Hallelujah that year, and Mamoulian did Applause, but Lubitsch made a string of musicals that really defined the musical genre, and the public was tremendously pleased, and a lot of directors would copy these things and imitate them, so they knew who Lubitsch was. I think he became kind of forgotten over the years. It was hard to see his films, too, and that was one of the reasons I wrote this book. I mean, I usually write a book because I'm bothered by some kind of injustice or oversight, and I want to correct it. I mean, and so with Lubitsch, I felt he's been kind of ignored. You don't hear about him in film schools very much, and people aren't writing much about him. There aren't very many books about him compared to, say, Hitchcock. One of the nice things about doing the book, How Did Lubitsch Do It, is a lot of people have come out of the closet, so to speak, as Lubitsch fans, or come up to me or send me emails or whatever and say, oh my God, I'm such a Lubitsch fan, and I'm so thrilled you wrote this book. And Lubitsch's daughter, Nicola, who I've gotten to know well, she's wonderful, very terrific lady. Mm-hmm. She said, this is the book I've been waiting for all my life. She was so thrilled that somebody wrote a book like this, really appreciating her father and going into detail. It's it's a long book because he had a long, rich career. And so I tried to see all these films, and he made 72 films, of which 49 survived in whole or in part. And that's a pretty good survival record for somebody from his era, because a lot of silent films have been lost. But
sure.
You know, some films I'd love to see have been lost, but other ones keep turning up, you know, and some have been restored. Recently, the Museum of Modern Art restored Rosita and Forbidden Paradise, which were only available in really awful prints for a long time. And a lot of his early American films are hard to see even now. A lot of his films have never been released on DVD or Blu-ray or VHS in this country. And there, some of the German films that are terrific have never been released in America, except they pop up on YouTube, for example. There's one called Cole Heasel's Daughters, which I would recommend people look up. Mm-hmm. It's a very hilarious sex farce made in Germany in 1920. It's just wonderful. Never released in America. They thought, I guess, it was too German, but it's just funny. It's a wonderful tour de force with Henny Porten, who is a famous German actress, playing a double role. She's great. But a lot of these films, you know, when I started in the 60s, I saw Trouble in Paradise, the first Lubitsch film I saw, and I thought, I've just seen this guy's masterpiece, because I thought, yeah, how could anybody top this? And I actually still feel that, because I've seen everything else since then, but I still think it's his perfect film, it's his best film. But he made a number of other terrific films, and but I wanted to see them in a selfish way, too. I just wanted an excuse to go to Europe and see these films. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you do a book, you... I mean, I did this one on my own and then sold it to Columbia University Press later, but so I was kind of self-financing this. But I went to Europe three times, went to Germany twice, and Switzerland once. They actually flew me over there to curate a Lubitsch retrospective at the Locarno Film Festival in 2010, and that was great because they got the best prints from all over Europe, and in some cases America, so I got to see all the films in 35mm, the best prints we could get, which was fabulous, and I introduced a lot of them, and Nicola Lubitsch came over there, and I got to meet her, and, you know, and then collectors send me copies of films that are hard to get, and, because when you do a book, you have to see the films over and over again, you can't just see them once, you know.
Of course, right, yeah.
So that's been, you know, a dream come true for me to see all these films and to share my enthusiasm and hope that other people will get inspired. And I'm very happy that some people write me and say, you know, since I got your book, I've been inspired to have a Lubitsch Festival, and I'm watching more and more on YouTube or buying DVDs. And then, as you say, GCM shows some Filmstruck before they went defunct, had 13 Lubitsch films. It's a shame that went away, but Criterion is coming back with a new streaming channel, and they have a number of Lubitsch films.
Oh, well, I was going to say, Warner Brothers is going to also have a streaming platform, and I'm sure, well, that TCM, because they kind of bifurcated. I mean, they were kind of paired up, which might have been a slightly odd to some, might have thought of it as an odd pairing, meaning TCM and Criterion, because they sort of have different brands in a way, you know, not in a way, they do.
Yeah.
And now, because then when Warner Brothers got bought by AT&T, I guess, they just, you know, they just decided they're going to do their own streaming platform. So I think we'll get all that stuff on whatever that becomes. And then
Warner's has it. They've never released, I don't know why, for example, there's a Lubitsch film from the 20s called Three Women, which is not terrific, but it's a good silent film, and Warner's made it, and I don't know why it's never been released on DVD.
Sounds like a John Ford movie.
What?
Sounds like a John Ford title. That's Seven Women and Three Outlaws, but anyway.
Well, Robert Altman made a film called Three Women, too.
That's true.
But actually, a better film that Warner's made in 1925, Lady Windermere's Van, the Lubitsch film, which is a masterpiece. It's fantastic. You can get that on one of those box sets of treasures from the American... what's it called, from the American Film Archives, and it's a beautiful, beautiful print, well preserved, but you have to buy it as part of the set. And so this is Paris is another film that Warner's made that I have a tape of it that came out some years ago, but it was restored recently. We showed it at UCLA, and Nicola Lubitsch came with me, and we introduced it. She'd never seen it. She was delighted by it. It's
wow.
Very funny, charming late silent film, but they haven't released that on DVD. There was a terrific box set. Tino Lorber put out a set of five German films of Lubitsch and a documentary about Robert Fischer, and that's highly recommend it because he made some fantastic films in Germany, Oyster Princess and I Don't Want to Be a Man, etc. You know, wonderful films. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you're reminding me, and I'm, I guess I'm going to gear up as I start, as I'm working my way through the Lubitsch book. One thing I love doing is, like I did with your John Ford book, is to go back and revisit, as well as finally see a lot of stuff. And for somebody like John Ford, you know, other than I imagine some of the silent films, the early silent films that he made, so much is available. And it just becomes this fantastic experience to be reading such a thorough, historic book about him and be able to see and watch the films again.
Yeah, with Ford, there are about 95 films that survived. He made 137 as a director.
John.
A lot of the silents are lost, unfortunately, but 25 silents now exist. Some are just part. But when I started researching Ford in the 60s, I wrote a book called John Ford with Mike Wilmington, a critical yep. study, and there were only 12 Ford silents available then. So 13 have turned up in the last 50 years, which is wonderful.
And how recently have the last one or two shown up?
Well, I think the last one was Upstream, which there was a big find in New Zealand at the National Film Archive there. A UCLA scholar was down there, and somebody at the archive said, we got a whole bunch of American films that some guy had. I think he was a projectionist, too. That was sort of the end of the road, Australia and New Zealand, for American films in those days, and they just wouldn't send them back because it wasn't worth shipping these nitrate films back, so they just threw them away. But this guy took them home, and he had unique prints of films. There was a film that Hitchcock worked on called Woman to Woman, and a lot of American films have turned up. Some you can see online now, but Upstream was a silent Ford film about theater people, which is quite charming. Mm-hmm. And that was in good shape, and so they restored that and released it. And but there's some short films of Ford. You know, Ford made a lot of shorts as an actor and as a director, and also with his brother Francis. And a lot of Francis's work is lost, but they've been rediscovering some of his films too, which is important. But they found a film, for example, called The Bandit's Wager in London, in which Francis directed the film, but John Ford plays a supporting role, and it's one of the few films we have left in which Ford really acts. He pops up in a couple things, but I discovered an OSS film. Ford made a lot of documentaries in World War II that nobody even knew existed. So I went into the National Archives and I found dozens of Ford films. But he produced most of those, or was executive producer, and he didn't direct most of them as in the way we think of directing. It's a film called Underground, which is an 80-minute film about how to be a spy. It's a training film, and he plays a role. He has two scenes where he plays a undercover spy who's in the import-export business is his front, and he's interviewing a prospective spy, and he's quite funny and quite good. You know, here's a little acting part. I actually heard about this from one of his Navy colleagues who said he had seen this film but couldn't remember it. I mentioned that in Searching for John Ford, but the film turned up, and you can see it now on YouTube, and actually I told Netflix about it when they did the Came Back series, and they put Underground on Netflix, I believe, because these are public domain films. So part of the job of a film historian, I always think, is to find films, discover films. I've discovered a few things, like Welles's early film, The Hearts of Age, which he made when he was 19, kind of avant-garde, amateur, strange little film, but very inventive visually. I discovered that back in the 60s through a tip from my film teacher, Russell Merritt in Madison, had lived in Greenwich, Connecticut, and he said they had a print at the local library, and I went there, and sure enough, there was a 16 print, because the guy who co-directed this film with Welles, a man named William Vance, had given this film to the library. He went on to make TV commercials. So anyway, this film popped up in the American Film Institute, preserved it, and now it's public domain, so you can see it all over YouTube. And Welles was very upset that I discovered this, because the myth that he fostered was that he came like a virgin filmmaker to Citizen Kane. He had no knowledge of anything. He kept telling people this, and he was so great that he could just other mm-hmm. people, but yeah, he had never directed a film, allegedly. But I, you know, in my research, I turned up evidence that he had done other things. And then Too Much Johnson is another Wells film that he made in 1938. It was supposed to be part of a stage production, but he shot a lot of footage, and that was thought lost until a few years ago. It turned up in Italy in a warehouse. It was just a very strange discovery. They were going to throw these cans of film out, and the guy who owned the warehouse knew a fellow who was with a local film club, and he said, "You want to look at these things?" And he recognized what this film was. So this film suddenly turns up. You can see it online now. It's the unedited work print that Wells didn't finish, and but it's fantastic to see it. It's in great shape, and it's extremely inventive.
So you're saying,
you know,
a film that Wells didn't finish it. Okay, that seems that's.
Well, he had problems with that film because it was supposed to be. He had this idea of doing this old stage farce by yeah. William Gillette, and interspersing film scenes that he shot around New York. It's supposed to take place in Cuba, so he had scenes in New York and scenes in Cuba, and it was in the style of slapstick comedy of Harold Lloyd and Max Sennett and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And so he was going to, I think, have four parts of 10 minutes each, something like that. And they ran into problems. He was doing too much at the time, and he was getting overwhelmed. He was starting his radio show at the same time, and he was doing theater.
Right. He was doing multiple plays sometimes. He would be in multiple productions at the same time.
Simultaneously. Yeah, and he was going to do this play in Connecticut to start and then bring it to New York. And Paramount, he didn't realize Paramount had made a film of this play years before, and there was they made some claim of ownership, which clouded the whole thing of can you show this film. And it later, Paramount decided that they weren't going to claim they owned the film, so it doesn't matter. But he also, at the theater where they're going to show it, it wasn't configured to show motion picture films. They were going to bring in projectors and stuff, but it just, the technical aspects were not working, so they had to abandon the project, and Wells didn't have time to finish cutting it. But yeah, there are a lot of unfinished films in Wells' career. And
yeah.
But they all have their own story behind them, as I say. It's like the line in Renoir's The Rules of the Game, the terrible thing about life is that everyone has his own reasons, has his reasons, and the terrible thing about each unfinished Wells film is that each one has his reasons for being unfinished, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I understand. It's a particularly unpleasant thing, a burden, you know, to carry that around, because with somebody who is so ambitious and brilliant, to have that as their part of their legacy, it just seems, it's lousy, you know? But,
well, it is and it isn't, but, you know, the real reason, and there's a lot of misunderstanding surrounding that, so I'm glad we're bringing that up. The Other Side of the Wind, which came out last year that I'm in, you know, he shot for 6 years, and he spent the last 15 years of his life trying to get this film finished, and it's not that he didn't try. He tried really hard, but he ran into all kinds of financial and legal problems and political problems, and he often did things that were very unusual and would get him into trouble for one reason or another. And also his sources of funding were usually unorthodox, often his own money. And then in this case, he needed more money, and he made a mistake of getting money from the Tom Aran's brother-in-law, which turned out not to be a smart idea.
Right.
And it's a long story, but he was making films on his own for the last 15 years of his life, literally home movies in the sense that he would shoot them mostly around his home, or, you know, he would rent a studio in Hollywood. And he was working outside the system. And so if he'd been allowed to work in the system, and if he'd been inclined to do it more, he wouldn't have had those problems. But his career was blighted by the problems that he ran into at RKO with Citizen Kane and Magnificent Ambersons, and it's all true. RKO fired him, and I discovered they fired him on false pretenses when he was in South America making
right.
this documentary.
They sent, in fact, they sent him to South America. It sounds like, from what I've read, the writings of Bogdanovich and others, that they actually sent him down there so they could take his film apart and take away all the control from, you know, away his control from that film. Is that true, that they actually... It was. I know they sent it there for a film project, but it seems like it was deceptive. But maybe that's not.
Well, yeah, there was a lot of deception about it. He was sent by the U.S. government because they wanted a propaganda film for what became known as the Good Neighbor Policy, trying to keep South America on our side in World War II, basically, and promote
containment.
To combat the possibility that some governments might side with the fascists, and also to make sure they're on our side. It was kind of a goodwill gesture. He really didn't want to do it, and he was shooting Ambersons, and he had to finish that in a hurry and get down to South America, and he was supposed to cut Ambersons down there with Robert Wise, and they didn't send Robert Wise, and so the studio took the film out of his hands. But he was trying to make this very ambitious documentary, and it mutated as his project tended to do, from something kind of impersonal into something much more personal. He fell in love with Brazilian culture and was making a multifaceted film about Brazilian culture and politics, and he was getting in trouble with the Brazilian government because he was filming in their slums around Rio, and they thought he was going to make this nice travelogue about how beautiful our country is. And then he was filming a story of three impoverished fishermen who were protesting for their rights. And so the Brazilians were upset. And then in Hollywood, the RKO was getting upset because he was mingling black and white performers in the film. And they were worried that the production manager of the film was a racist who would send these racist emails back to the studio and alarm them. And they were worried that they couldn't release the film in the South, for example, because back in those days you didn't mingle black and white people as friends or having fun. They were, you know, black people were always servants. So Wells was challenging the norms of both countries. As usual, he was a troublemaker, and he would get in trouble with the establishment wherever he was. And so RKO... And Wells was sent there without a script, and it told make up a script as you go along, make up this film, because there was no preparation time. He had to get down to film the carnival. So, and then he was blamed by RKO, well, you didn't have a script, you didn't know what you're doing. But, you know, a lot of documentary filmmakers do that. They go there and find out what's going on and construct the film, and he was doing that.
And also...
He had a lot of footage.
And also... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, they claimed he was... They fired him because they claimed he was over budget. And I found the papers in the RKO files that prove that they actually lied to him. And I actually have two transcripts of telephone calls between RKO executives that they said, we're not telling Wells what the budget is in this film. It was $1.2 million, and he wasn't supposed to know that. They lied to him. And he thought it was around $1 million, but they never told him what the real budget was. And so when he was fired for going over budget, he was actually $447,000 under budget. I mean, this is shocking. This is the smoking gun of Wells' career.
Yeah, right.
And then they spread this story, which people to this day keep repeating in books and articles, and people believe it, that he's this wastrel guy who was run out of Hollywood because he spent so much money and couldn't finish films, and you know, they took it out of his hands, and he tried for years to get this film finished. That film was lost for a long time until it turned up unexpectedly at Paramount, parts of it, and then a good documentary was made reconstructing parts of it. But that was the big tragedy of his career in terms of Hollywood. That and the cutting of Ambersons, they chopped up Ambersons. I did a video interview for Criterion for their recent Blu-ray DVD edition of Ambersons, and I talk about all this, what they did to Ambersons and how they fired him. And they spread the story that he couldn't work with him, and he got a few Hollywood directing jobs after that, but he was kind of under a lot of constraints and sort of genre films, except he made Macbeth for Republic, which was quite a remarkable film. Low-budget Macbeth, very avant-garde. But he was pretty unemployable as a director by then because his films were not making money. And The Blacklist was starting. The HUAC hearings had just begun, and he left America in a big hurry right at that time because he would have been blacklisted, and I believe he was blacklisted. He's in Red Panels, which is the book of, it's the Bible of the blacklist. If you were in there, you were blacklisted, and you had to clear yourself in some way to get off it. So he spent from 1947 to 56 almost all of that time in Europe and making films in Europe, and he became an independent filmmaker, but not, well, he didn't have any option, really, but he... part of my thesis in my book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career, which I borrowed from a colleague, Douglas Gomerie, is that Welles was always an independent filmmaker by nature, and he briefly had the resources of a major studio, but he thought and he worked like an independent,
Right.
And so he winds up being an independent filmmaker in Europe, scrambling to make films, and then he comes back to America to make Touch of Evil, and he was thrilled that his studio would invite him back, and it was a fluke, and he made this wonderful film, and then they fired him.
No, they were so angry at him.
Away
yeah,
they were, it was too strange for them.
Yeah, they were mortified by the results.
A great film, but
he's so far ahead of his time.
He was so traumatized, he never wanted to work for the studios again, and, you know, he was really, they didn't want to hire him either. So he was making independent films in Europe and America on his own, and I think he should be praised for that and not mocked like a lot of people do. But when you do that, sometimes you don't finish the films or you have a lot of problems with them.
Well, your narrative, it would take a lot of work to get your narrative to reverse that other narrative that's been out there, you know. But you're right. It sounds like the very thing that produced the same sort of talent and brain that produced Orson Welles' first major success was also his undoing, because his outsized ego and independent streak, directorial, what's it called? He was given...
Well, he had Final Cut.
Final Cut, right?
It's a little bit of a myth. He claimed to have complete carte blanche. The only person who's really ever had that in Hollywood is Charlie Chaplin, because he owned his own studio, and he was the star and the director, and he paid for his own films. But Welles had as close to that as you can get in the system back then.
Okay.
But RKO had certain rights that they could cut the film for censorship or for foreign distribution. They actually did, the film ran into some problems with, of course, the Hearst organization attacked the film, and so the studios got worried about it and tried to destroy Kane. They were going to try to buy the film from RKO and burn it. And Welles talked them into releasing it. And Robert Wise, who edited the film, told me he was there, and he said it was Welles' greatest performance. They showed the film in a screening room at the Radio City Music Hall to the heads of the corporations that owned the studios and their lawyers. And Welles gave this speech. He said it was the greatest performance of his life. That he gave this eloquent speech about the world is fighting fascism and we're defending freedom of speech and freedom of thought, and this is a battle for freedom of speech, and it's against dictatorship. And, you know, he moved them so much that they agreed to release the film, but they forced him to make some cuts of a few things that worried them. For example, there was an allegation that Hearst helped inspire the assassination of President McKinley with inflammatory editorials, and the film implied that, and so Robert Wise said he spent 5 weeks making changes in Kane, which people don't realize, and in the film there's a very sketchy allusion to that, but they toned that down, and other things like that. But Kane was audacious. When you say he had a big ego, well, yeah, most directors do, but part of it is the audacity of this guy, and I think that's one reason I was attracted to him in the first place as a young guy. A 24-year-old guy attacking William Randolph Hearst, making this very daring political expose, very ambitious film artistically, that kind of rewrote the textbook of how to make films. That's what got him in trouble. A lot stems from that in his career troubles, when you take on the most powerful media baron in the country.
Right.
And the studios didn't like that at all, and RKO, there were people there who never liked him, never wanted him to be hired in the first place, and they almost destroyed him over that, and they almost destroyed this film that a lot of people think is the greatest film ever made. You know, literally burned this film. Could you imagine if that had happened? So that was kind of the inciting incident, as they call it in screenwriting, that triggered a lot of other things that happened in his career.
No, absolutely. So I guess this begs the question, how did your path lead to Orson Welles, and how did you, as a young man, how did you meet him, and how did you end up being involved as an actor in the 70s for The Other Side of the Wind?
Yeah, it's quite a funny story. It's kind of a Walter Mitty adventure story, you know, for a young guy. Mm-hmm. I was 19, and I was at the University of Wisconsin, September 22nd, 1966. I remember the day so well, because it changed my life.
I bet.
I was in my first film class, Professor Richard Byrne, which was Susan King. I'd never seen this, and when I went to Wisconsin, I wanted to be a journalist and novelist. I was already a journalist, but I thought I'd write novels. And then I saw Kane, and it changed my life, and I thought, okay, I want to make films and write about films. I was so excited. And I somehow managed to get a print of the film, 16-millimeter print. Back then, it was hard to get your hands on films. And I ran it 60 times in the next 3 or 4 years. And there was also the screenplay was at the State Historical Society in Madison. It was in a collection there.
You do, so by the way, share that also with Wells, is that you both come from Wisconsin, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that was part of my attraction. I thought, wow, the guy from Wisconsin and the youth of this fellow, you know, the young man that a lot of Truffaut said that about. He said more filmmakers have been inspired by Kane to start their careers than any other film, and part of it is his youth inspired people. When I met Wells, I said, I'd like to direct a film by the time I'm 25, like you did. And I mean, he was 25 when it came out. And he kindly said, you will, but I didn't, you know, but. I was making my own little films, and I was writing screenplays and teaching myself how to write scripts, but I was typing the script of Kane by Herman Mankiewicz and Wells because I couldn't afford to Xerox the thing. I was still broke, so for a month I would lug my typewriter up there and type the exact copy of the script.
You would?
And so, yeah, so that was my Bible, that and the film, and I was running a film society on campus so I could show the film to myself as often as I wanted. I was seeing all kinds of other films. So I spent 4 years writing this book on Wells while I was running these film societies and I was washing dishes. I was living very hand-to-mouth thing, but I was excited because I was teaching myself film history and film writing. I had already written a book on baseball when I was in high school, so I kind of knew how to write a book.
On baseball?
And yeah, the baseball book is called High and Inside, An A to Z Guide to the Language of Baseball, which is about slang. Baseball slang was a passion of mine. And it didn't come out until 1980. Put it in the 60s. It took a long time to get published. But so anyway, I was almost done with this book on Wells, and then I was going to start a book on John Ford with Mike Wilmington.
Right.
I figured Ford was such a big subject, I needed a collaborator, and Mike was a very brilliant guy and a good actor, and he taught me a lot about acting, and so we were working on this book on Ford, and then I went to Hollywood to interview John Ford in 1970, which was quite a thing to get an interview with him, because he was very hard to interview. He didn't like to give interviews.
Not only did he not suffer fools, he didn't suffer anybody who wasn't a fool as well.
He was tough to really. It's funny because I have the tape of the interview and I put it online recently.
Yep.
You can Google it.
Yep.
It's an unedited tape. It's kind of embarrassing in a way because I was kind of ghost and flustered to interview this great man who was difficult. He really gave me a hard time. I mean, he was nice and he was funny because he could be warm and nice and one moment, the next moment say something really cutting. And then he would pretend like he didn't remember films. I tried to talk about Fort Apache, which was a film that meant a lot to me then, and he claimed he didn't remember it, you know, and things like this, and I didn't know what was going on. I mean, you know, he was pulling my leg, which he did with interviewers all the time.
But anyway, you're saying...
he retired in the middle of the interview. Toward the end of the interview, he actually announced his retirement. I came on the last day of his career.
Right.
Just by chance, by awful chance, during the interview, he kept asking his secretary in a very anxious voice, has the gentleman from Italy called? You know, have you gotten a letter from this gentleman? Has he called us? I didn't know what he was talking about, but he seemed very preoccupied, and the last thing he wanted to do was talk to some young guy about his old movies. And,
right.
Then he said, you know, I'm just a hardworking, hard-nosed, hardworking, and then there was a long pause. He said, ex-director, and I'm trying to retire gracefully. And then I found, looking at his papers many years later, I looked up that week, and what he was doing was waiting for word from Italy on a Western that Woody Strode, his actor friend, was trying to promote Woody Strode to become an actor, I mean, a star in Italian Westerns. And so he was trying to get Ford to do an Italian Western, and there was a producer who was interested, and Ford was waiting for the word and didn't come. So he knew that was when he realized this is the end of my career.
When they didn't,
so here
and,
I am.
Yeah. Let's just pause for a second, though, Joe, and appreciate the irony of the fact that Ford, in the waning days of his life or his career anyway, was considering making a spaghetti Western
yeah.
when the spaghetti Western was invented because of American Westerns, and that they, you know, were making these much cheaper Westerns shot with Spanish actors, and, you know, they would bring over some character actors from the States whose careers were kind of on the decline, and in some cases actually saw a new chapter in their like, you know,
or somebody like Clint Eastwood became a star.
Of course, I'm even thinking even not so big a case, but, you know, Lee Van Cleef all of a sudden had a new career, and Woody Strode's career continued, and then John Ford is trying to make it, and he can't even pull that off. But I just so much to appreciate. At that same meeting when you're interviewing Ford, didn't you pull out at the end something that you commemorated to him, some work of yours?
Oh, well, I published a book in Madison called Persistence of Vision,
right,
which is a collection of criticism by me and other people at the Wisconsin Film Society, and we had some things in there about Ford and Wells, and it was dedicated to Ford. I gave him a copy of the book, and he lifted his eyeglasses up because he couldn't see very well.
He's blind,
And he said, "Oh, that's sweet," which I thought was really interesting because, actually, as a future biographer, I wasn't planning to do a biography in 1970, but within a year, I began thinking there needs to be a biography of him because there's never hadn't been one at that point. But, you know, it was an invaluable experience to be with him for an hour of his life, even though he didn't say much. Sometimes, actually, some of the things he said were very interesting, but some were ridiculous. But just to observe him, his body language and his personality, and he seemed very vulnerable to me, which was surprising. Here I'm a young guy, and he's been in the business for 50 years, and he should have been more secure, but he seemed very insecure. And it was partly because he'd been kicked around for 5 years and hadn't been allowed to make a film and was forgotten. It was a terrible thing. And that's what started Wells on doing The Other Side of the Wind, was Peter Bogdanovich telling him about how terrible it is that Ford and Hawks are having trouble making films. And he told Wells the details. And Wells said he was so upset he couldn't sleep that night. And he went back to his hotel and he started thinking, I better make a film about this. And that was the impetus. Wells had been planning to make a similar film some years before called The Sacred Beast, which was going to be about a Hemingway-esque figure who was following bullfights. And it was going to be a deconstruction of macho sensibilities, which is what The Other Side of the Wind is.
Right.
But it was going to be set in the world of bullfighting, but it was going to be about filmmaking as well. But he became galvanized again to, okay, let's focus it on a great old director from the Hollywood past who's having trouble making a film or finishing a film. And he's coming back to Hollywood to try to, you know, capitalize on the youth movement, and it doesn't work. And he's trying to get fan money for his film. And, you know, so this all came together. And it was kind of interesting. It all ties in because right at that time I met Bogdanovich, and I went to Larry Edmonds' bookshop, and I knew that, I mean, Peter had done this wonderful interview book with Ford in 1968, which was so rare that somebody had all this access to Ford, and I wanted to talk to Peter about Ford and Wells, and I admired his film Targets, which I had seen in 1968 when I was at the Democratic Convention protesting. I took time out to see Targets. So I got his phone number and called him, and he said, come on over to the house. He was living in a very modest house in Van Nuys. And he very nicely talked to me for 3 hours, answered all my questions about Ford and Wells, because they were, a lot of what they were doing was mysterious at the time to me. And it turned out that Wells had asked Peter to round up some cineasts, characters to be in this film.
Oh, okay.
And so he recommended to Wells, there's this guy I met, and Peter told me, at the premiere of the film at Telluride, he said, I had been at a screening of Fellini's Satyricon, so I scribbled notes on my wrist. I ran out of paper, and I was writing notes with my pen. And I still do this when I'm going to school or whatever. I'll jot down a few words, or if I think of something. It's just a funny habit. Peter thought this was hilarious, and he told Wells, he said, I met this funny guy who's a film buff, and he writes on his hand, and Wells thought that was hysterically funny, so he said, well, put him in the film, you know. So, what was this, 2 or 3 days later, I wound up being in an Orson Welles film.
Yeah. Wow. So there you were, and there's John Huston and Rich Little, right?
Yeah. Everybody else in the world, too, yeah.
And all these make a stock of these almost like a John Ford stock characters, right? I mean, he had his stable of actors that he used, and you kind of created that around. They weren't all actors, but you created this, like, exists on these huge characters like Orson Welles, and they have all these people that are that are in that gravitational orbit, you know, around somebody like that, you know.
Yeah, it was kind of, there was a lot of Ford in the Hannaford character.
Yeah, there
Hannaford
is
a composite figure,
right,
composed mostly of Hemingway, but also, as Welles told me, he's partly Ford, he's partly Hawks, Houston, those.
And Welles.
And Welles, yeah, there are elements of Welles' own story, but he's unlike Welles in that he's this macho, blowhard,
right,
skirt-chasing guy, which Welles was not that kind of a man, you know.
Yeah.
So he was really kind of trying to attack the Hemingway ethos of, he admired him as an artist, but as a man he thought he was kind of a sham. And a lot has been written about Hemingway. There was a very good biography recently by a woman, the first time a woman has written a biography of Hemingway, and it gets a lot of fresh insights into his sexuality and his vulnerability. And that's one reason I've always liked his work. He's my favorite writer because, contrary to his macho image, he writes a lot about male fragility and male insecurity and, all these issues surrounding masculinity, which is what Welles is delving into in the film. This is years before other people were even aware of this. And so he combined all these things into this film that he started shooting that weekend. By the way, the day I met Ford, later that day I went to Jean Renoir's house and I met him.
Renoir? The same day?
So I met
The same day you talked to Ford?
Yeah, I went to see Ford, then I went over to Renoir's house and met him. He was wonderful by comparison to Ford. He was such a nice, charming guy to talk to. So in my first week in Hollywood, I met my three favorite directors, and I also met Peter Bogdanovich, who I admired a lot. And I left a request with Hitchcock for an interview, and he actually called my hotel and said, come on over, and they didn't give me the message. So I missed seeing Hitchcock. Oh, I could have met him in 1 week. So I actually, the funny thing about that week is, I kind of thought all weeks in Hollywood would be like this. It was really an amazing week, of course. I realized later this was the pinnacle of my Hollywood life. It's been downhill ever since.
Well, they can't take that week away from you, Joe.
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience, but it was kind of a one-of-a-kind thing too. I only had 1 hour with Ford, and I got to know Renoir better years later. I met him again at a screening of The Story of Adele H, and I would go see him every Saturday with Todd McCarthy, who's now the Hollywood Reporter, film critic, and Todd and I would show him 16mm prints of new and old films because he couldn't get out much because he was in a wheelchair.
Oh, okay.
And so we would watch films, or he would show some of his films to us, and we'd sit and talk to him, and it was a wonderful thing that for the last 3 years of his life we did that. We got to know him
quite
well.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. I love his introductions to his films that they show, you know, a Criterion has them before he introduces each one. They're so beautiful. I love his introductions.
Those are great. Yeah, he did those for French television, and several of the films have those filmed interviews that are filmed introductions that are great. So I came at a great time where all these people were around to interview, and a lot of them felt neglected. Hawks also was very accessible to me, and I did an interview book with him, Hawks on Hawks, and they were flattered that some young guy, and not just me, but Peter and other people too, knew their work, and it was a thrill because most people in Hollywood didn't know who they were anymore, and so we'd ask them real specific questions about their films, and they got to talk about them, and then I would publish these things in film magazines or in books, so I was doing them a favor as well.
Right.
And then I was getting to learn about film history. I went to see Hawks a lot, partly because I was trying to be a screenwriter, and he was a master of storytelling. And even though he didn't write his own scripts, he always worked with the writers, so he really could tell me a lot about how to do screenplays and everything else. And so I was learning. This is kind of my film school, that and Variety. I was a film critic and reporter for Variety, so I got to go on sets of films, and I met all kinds of contemporary filmmakers, and from not only American but foreign filmmakers who came to Hollywood. And I could, in those days, you can't do that as much anymore because the industry has gotten very corporate, but back then you could call up and say, can I come on the set tomorrow of such and such a film, and they'd say, sure, come on over. And you know, you can interview the director and the stars and whatever, cameraman. And so I got to see a lot of films being shot, which was very important to me because when I was in Wisconsin, I had only a very vague idea of how films were made. And when you're a film historian, it really helps to know the nuts and bolts of filmmaking. And so I've had sort of four careers. I'm a journalist, I was a screenwriter, I'm a historian and biographer, and I'm a teacher now, and they all kind of tie in with each other, but it's unusual for people to do all those things. But screenwriting, and that helped me a lot to understand filmmaking and also how Hollywood works. I couldn't have written these biographies without being in the trenches and understanding the business, which I also got from Variety. And then I could see all these people. I spent 3 days watching Hitchcock shoot Family Plot, for example, his last film, which was a real thrill to watch Hitchcock at work. And so I was able to learn by all this. But I'd say Wells was more my film school. You know, I spent 5+ years acting in The Other Side of the Wind. And he put me in there because he wanted people to play sort of funny versions of themselves, slightly exaggerated satirical versions of themselves. And he wanted what he called personages as much as actors. He had a lot of great actors in the film, but he had people playing themselves or versions of themselves. And so he surrounded Houston's character with all these Hollywood characters, media people and film people. And so I became one of them. He thought I was funny, and he kept bringing me back for more and more. And in 1971, we did a lot of shooting in L.A., and by then he had written a complete script. And one of the sort of the myths of this film is it's kind of improvised, but he had talked about improvising the whole film, but he didn't actually wind up doing that, except in my case to some extent, because the way we would work, he would talk to me for like an hour before the shoot every day, and he would say, "What would you ask Hannaford?" And I play a young critic who follows Houston's character around, asking him sort of silly or probing film buff questions that get him irritated. And so I would say, "How about if I ask him this and this and this?" You know, and then Wells would reject some ideas and take some ideas, and then he would build on them. And so we were kind of writing these questions together, and then he would type them out, and he would do, you know, embellish upon them, usually to make them a little more pretentious sounding, because he was making fun of academic or intellectual critics.
Right.
And then he would type it up, and I'd have to read it exactly and, you know, memorize it and hit the marks exactly. And he didn't allow me to improvise any gestures or words at all once we had agreed on it, but I did have the input into it. Some of the questions I ask in the film are things I thought of, like asking, is the camera a phallus, which a lot of people think is funny. I actually stole that from Peter Fonda, said that about Roger Vadim in an interview in Esquire.
Oh, really?
He said, his camera is a phallus, man, you know. So I said that to Wells, but I picked up
that was his brother-in-law.
Sexual obsessions of this film. You know,
it's a weird question to ask your brother-in-law.
Well, yeah, I mean, and
Peter asking Roger
with Rex Reed, he was talking about this film that they were going to do. It was an Edgar Allan Poe film, *Spirits of the Dead*, that the Dean contributed to, and he was married to Jane Fonda, and Peter Fonda wanted to be her lover in this film and to have an incestuous thing going. And he said, "Wow, wouldn't that be cool, man?" I mean, you know, Peter Fonda was pretty out there at the time.
Clearly,
you can find this interview.
Clearly, yeah.
But I thought in this film the character is a super phallic character, and the film is sort of about the death of phallocracy, to use a fancy word.
If that's a word? That's a real word?
It's a real word. I checked. Yeah. Okay. Actually, even at the end of the film, there's a giant phallus that topples over in the film within the film. I think it's hysterically funny, but nobody ever laughs when we see that scene. But I think it's like a 6-foot phallus, and it falls over as Zoya Kodar is walking around naked. And I mentioned that to Frank Marshall, you know, who was one of the producers, and he said, "Oh, I was inside that phallus. He was the guy who made it topple over.
Oh,
he was standing inside, and he pushed it over, and he fell over." That was how they did that.
I
so I had that line in there, and then Wells thought it was hysterically funny, and so we in, and I also asked him about how his father's suicide affected his film work, and I was thinking of Hemingway's father killing himself and how that affected Hemingway. And I didn't realize that Wells thought his father had committed suicide, even though his death certificate indicates he died of heart and liver disease in a hotel room in Chicago. But Wells thought he had killed himself and he was responsible for it because he had cut his father off. He was an alcoholic. And he was practicing what we call tough love, you know, like, mm-hmm. I won't see you again until you stop drinking. And then his father dies, you know, miserable death in this hotel room. And Wells said, I always felt guilty about that, and I've never forgiven myself. He said, that's why I don't believe in psychoanalysis, because he said, I don't think you should forgive yourself. You should live with it. And I think that's the root of all the betrayals in all his films. They're all about male betrayal. Two men love each other, and one betrays the other and destroys the other or destroys himself, and there are variations on this, but all the Wells films are about that, really. Mm. And The Other Side of the Wind is about that. So I think Wells was excited by that question.
Chimes of Midnight comes to mind.
Chimes of Midnight is the perfect example of mm-hmm. Falstaff and Prince Hal.
Right.
Love each other like a father and son, and then he betrays the old man, and the old man dies of a broken heart.
Right.
When Hal becomes the king, he doesn't want to be associated anymore with this drunken old guy, and that's very close to Wells's heart. And at the end of the film, at the end of Other Side of the Wind, late in the film, there's a scene Wells wrote in 1974, and I found it in my script recently, where I materialize from behind a cactus, and I'm trying to be helpful to Hannaford and suggest that I could ask Bogdanovich's character for money to help him, you know, which is the real sore point in the film. It's the height of presumption for this young guy to do this. And then Paul Stewart's character says, who let this yo-yo in here? And then Hannaford says to me, we don't ask our chums for money, you know, and then he looks at me and he says, always remember that your heart is God's little garden, which is a line Wells used to use. I don't know why, you know, it was just one of his funny lines that he would say, you know, always remember your heart is God's little garden. Originally, Houston was supposed to pinch me on the cheek when he said that, but when we filmed it, I was really looking forward. That was my big scene with Houston. But when we filmed it, he was not there. And I asked one of the crew, I said, where's Houston? And he said, oh, he's off making some little film somewhere. Turned out he was doing the Man Who Would Be King.
Oh, The Man Who Would Be King.
In Morocco, which is his greatest film. And it's, you know, big epic in a way.
You think than The Treasure of Sierra Madre?
Huh?
More than Treasure of Sierra Madre?
Well, I think those are very similar films in their style and themes, but I think The Man Who Would Be King is just a great, perfect film, but the other one is great, too. So anyway, we had to double Houston. There was Houston.
Yeah.
But the way it's edited by Bob Murawski, who did a fantastic job of editing all the footage, you couldn't tell that Houston and I are not there together. It's edited, so it looks like we're having an intimate conversation. But, you know, the funny thing was when I saw the film for the first time all put together in January 2018, I'm a consultant on the film with Jonathan Rosenbaum, and they brought me down to look at it and make comments, and I offered some suggestions, some of which they took and some they didn't. But I had totally forgotten that scene. I had no memory of that. And I have a good memory, but I had forgotten doing that.
Clearly.
And, then I went home and I looked at my script, and there I found the folded pages of this inserted scene, you know, and it's a pretty good little scene. But it plays off that theme of, actually what happens with the suicide theme is really a major theme in the film later when Hannaford reveals to, he's talking to Peter's character about how his own father killed himself, hanged himself from a chandelier at the Hollywood Hotel. And it's a very devastating scene, and Peter's character knows about it, and you know, because he's an expert on Hannaford, and it's clearly blighted Hannaford's whole life. And so Wells picked up on that theme, and I don't know if he would have done that if I hadn't brought it up originally. One thing I'm a little disappointed by in the film, originally the idea was when I asked Hannaford that line in the car, I got thrown out of his car because I offend him with that question, which I thought was kind of cool. And there is a scene of me being thrown out of the car and then the camera pulls away. But for whatever reason, Wells shot a scene later of Gregory Sierra pulling up on a motorcycle. He's supposed to be like John Milius, and he says, "You guys are overloaded. You're going to have to lose somebody in the car." And they tell me to get out of the car.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're there. That's right. That's you.
It's not as interesting, you know.
Yeah, that's right. That's you.
It would have been funnier if I got thrown out for offending the guy.
You got a producer credit on it, ultimately?
No, I was trying to produce the film back in the 90s. Gary Graber, the cameraman, who's really the hero of the whole thing, he made the whole film possible. He kept trying for decades to get this film finished. And in the 90s, I thought, you know, I really got to get this out. So I called Gary and I said, let's join forces and let's try to get the money to finish the film. And we were going to get Peter to edit the film and finish it, which he was involved finally in doing that. And Gary had put together a kind of a very, very rough cut, which was sort of misleading because it wasn't the whole film. It was just certain scenes, but it was about 95 minutes long, and we showed it to people, and they couldn't really
follow it
very well.
Right.
And it was sort of a mess. There were some scenes that were very well edited by Wells, and then some things that Gary just threw in there. And it kind of had the unfortunate effect of looking like a very messy feature film instead of just scenes. I said, let's go back and cut it down to like an hour and just have the 40 minutes Wells edited with maybe 20 minutes of other stuff. And Gary didn't want to do that, but we showed it to everybody. Spielberg, Lucas, Clint Eastwood, Oliver Stone, all these people passed on it. And the only place that was interested was Showtime. And I had this unusual idea. Back in the 90s, this was very unusual. Go to a cable company and finish the film if the studios don't want it, and powerful producers and directors don't want to help us, you know, screw these people, let's you know. So there was a guy at Showtime, Matthew Duda, who was an executive who wanted to do it, but they made a $3 million offer. I made up this budget of $3 million to pay for the rights and post-production, and then Peter and Oya Kotar fired me as soon as we made that deal, because they felt they didn't need me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just walked away from it. You know, I mean, I thought it was very unfair, but I just figured the film is just so much trouble, I'm not going to make any more trouble. I just walked away. And then the deal collapsed right after that.
The Showtime deal.
Wells' daughter, Beatrice, started causing trouble.
Okay.
I kind of think if they hadn't fired me, the film might have been out around 2004, you know, because I would have gotten it done. But all those years after that, Showtime kept trying to make a deal, but it was very difficult to make a deal with the rights holders. A very, very long story. Josh Karp wrote an interesting book about that.
Yeah, he's been on here.
People, and I wrote a lot about that in my book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, this very long, bizarre story of trying to finish this film. And finally, new people came in. Filip Jan Rymza, who's a young Polish-born filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Marshall, who had been with the film from the beginning, almost from the beginning. He was a young production assistant, production manager in 1971 when I met him. And so they got together with Peter, and they managed to pull it off. And Filip negotiated for 9 years with Oya Kotar. I mean, she was very difficult to negotiate with, and he finally got the rights from her and the Iranian investor's family. And I mean, I'm glad, frankly, that I was fired, because I wouldn't have wanted to spend 9 years of my life suffering like that. And then Frank has a lot of clout in Hollywood, and he was able to get all kinds of things done, and he got Netflix involved. And Netflix, to their great credit, believed in the film. Ian Brick and Ted Sarandos, the executives at Netflix, really are visionaries, because they understood that it's important to get this Orson Welles film finished. And they weren't totally sure there was enough there to make a complete film, because until they went into the vault in Paris and inventoried all the film, nobody was quite sure did all the film exist and what shape it was in. I mean, but it all turned out to be there. Some of the original sound was lost, but they had dupes of some of the soundtracks. But there's a good documentary called The Final Cut for Orson, 40 Years in the Making, which is on Showtime, that shows the amazing post-production. So they Netflix put up $6 million and had the faith in this film, which I think is, they're like the George Schaefer's of 2018. George Schaefer was the executive who hired Wells on Kane, and that's the only time he ever had an executive like that in his career, who just believed in him and let him pretty much wrong, and I told them that, and they were happy to hear that, because, you know, I mean, that's what we wanted all those years, was people with some money who would have faith in Wells. Sure, it's an important film, let's finish it. Why not? Not everybody's going to like it, not everybody did like it, but generally it got a lot of acclaim and a lot of high rankings in critics' polls, and Sight and Sound list of international critics. I think it came in number 13 or 14 for the year. And
I saw it at the New York Film Festival at Alice Tully Hall, and the audience was howling. I mean, they were so enthusiastic, this audience I sat with. They wanted to, I mean, I know this doesn't sound like a real compliment, but they wanted to love the film, and then they really did love the film. But, you know, it's like this they went in with they were very primed, and they went in with this tremendous appetite of the anticipation of all the years and all the close calls, and it was worth the wait. Personally,
I didn't know you were at that screening. I was there too. I went there. It was very exciting.
Yeah,
and before that was the Telluride American premiere. The first screening was shortly before that in Venice. I wasn't there, but such excitement among film buffs both in Telluride and New York, because they've been waiting for decades, people like us, you know, wanting to see this film and wondering, you know, it's kind of like a dream come true. A lot of people thought we'd never get to see this film. I was beginning to wonder, would we ever see this? And here it comes together. And I think Bob Murawski did just an amazing job of making it all work beautifully. He had 96 hours of footage, and the editing is fantastic. He built it around Wells' scenes that Wells had edited and established the style, and he made it play in the same style, and the sound work was wonderful. You know, it took a lot of work to get the sound right, and a very complex sound design, as in all Wells films, and then the music by Michel Legrand. And it looks so great. The color looks fabulous. Gary Graver's cinematography is so beautiful, but the work print that we showed for years looked very battered and faded, and so to finally see it the way it's supposed to look, you know, even Wells and Gary had never seen all the footage, because unlike on most films, they didn't print everything. They would just put it away, and so they never saw this stuff. And so here we are watching this film at Alice Tully Hall. It was quite an experience. And Martin Scorsese, he remember, came out, and he had just seen it for the first time a couple days before, and he gave a wonderful appreciation of it, and what a surprise it was. A lot of people said that it was a surprising film for Wells, because Wells never made the same kind of film twice.
Right.
And in a way, that was part of his problem, because people didn't quite know how to pigeonhole him like they did other, even great directors like Ford and Hawks. You kind of knew what you were going to get.
Yeah,
with variations. But with Wells, or Kubrick, I compare him to Kubrick, each film they made was completely different and unexpected from what they'd done before. And so people would come in and see 2001 and say, what the heck is this? You know, they just seemed like Dr. Strangelove. And then it took 2 years to catch up to 2001.
Right.
And then they'd finally say, oh, that's a great film. That's often what happens with Wells. So I think the reputation of Other Side of the Wind will just keep growing over time. And some critics said, and this was intelligent, I think, that there's so much going on in this film, it's so complex and layered, that it's going to take a while for us to fully understand everything he's doing.
Right.
I mean, I didn't have trouble understanding. Some people thought, I don't get it. But, I mean, I'm close to it, but it is a dense, complex, difficult film in some ways, and it does take time for people to get acclimated to a new kind of storytelling. And Scorsese said Wells was reinventing the language of cinema, which I thought was a wonderful thing to say. And Wells did that throughout his career, and he's doing it again in a new way. It's a very fresh film. You know, it's kind of a mind-blowing thing if you think this, if this had come out in 73, let's say, it would have been so far ahead of its time. Even now, it's ahead of its time in terms of the style and themes. It kind of stunned people in some ways. Back then, I think it would have totally blown their minds. But so it comes at a good time. I think it's a good
time
for it to come out.
I think so too. Let's just remind people again of your newest book, which is, I guess, it is approaching, like this spring it'll be approaching, it's 1 year that it's been out, but it's called How Did Lubitsch Do It, and it's written by Joseph McBride and published by Columbia University Press. And it's available wherever books are sold, and it is one of many of your books. This ended up the reverse of how I intended it, but it couldn't have gone any better. What I would love to do at, you know, when it makes sense, do I am so fascinated, because I just came off of reading the John Ford book, and even though we did talk about him somewhat in this conversation, you know, first of all, I feel like after reading that book, all 750-plus pages, that I really felt like this guy was alive. I mean, I come after reading it, and I miss him. I miss him. You know, I miss him.
Thank you.
But yeah, I mean, he came to life. And so I want to talk about it because he's so complicated a guy. So like some of the, like so many of these other guys that we're talking about. So,
that's
but
great subject and hard, enigmatic character.
Yeah.
That's why it took me a long time to do that book, and I'm very happy with it.
And you really,
but he's not an easy man to understand. But he's endlessly fascinating, as are his films.
No, but I want to explore it with you, and it doesn't have to be two hours. But I want to come back, and I think this is a great place to end this particular conversation. But I do want to come back and do something special for on John Ford, and maybe there's an occasion. Maybe there's an anniversary or something coming up.
Well, actually, this is his 125th birthday being celebrated this month.
It is?
He was born February 1st, 1894, and in the state of Maine, where he's from, they've been celebrating with special events. They've been having in Portland, Maine, which is the town where he grew up, and other places they've been showing his films and having talks and conferences. So this is his 125th year, that's a good excuse.
Okay, so that doesn't give us a whole lot of time, but let's maybe in the next week or two
it'll be his 125th year for a whole year.
That's true.
I figure you should celebrate your birthday for a whole year.
I agree, especially if it's your 125th. If only he had made it this long. Anyway, let's do this. I would love to have another because I have so many thoughts on him, and it was such a gratifying read as I was racing towards the ending, but I was just... At one time, I couldn't wait to finish it. On the other hand, I was dreading finishing it. You know how that goes. Well, thank you for this.
It's a sad ending in some ways because he was rejected, but on the other hand, he made such fabulous films in the later part of his work, and I think they were underappreciated, so I was trying to do justice to them, so I'm very happy with the last part of that.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about it. I have not seen Seven Women. I have to get a copy of it. It's not so readily available, but I finally caught up with quite a few, including Cheyenne Autumn and... a number of others that
I think Seven Women is on the internet now. Somebody told me.
I'll find it. I'm resourceful that, as you can tell.
Yeah. I think it's on some streaming channel or something. It's a really great film.
I'll find it. Yeah, no, I look forward to it. Well, thank you so much, Joe. Thank you. Really appreciate all your time and so many wonderful...
Well, thank you, Adam. It's been great. Really interesting discussion, and I appreciate all your good questions and all the things you brought up. It's real food for thought.
I didn't get to a fraction of them, but as you know, you have so much to share, I didn't really even anticipate it being quite as plentiful as it is, you know, just the sheer quantity of stories. But we'll come back together shortly.
Yeah, great. Anytime.
Okay, I appreciate it.
I'm really happy. I look forward to our next talk.
Me too.
And talking about Ford is one of my favorite things, so it's terrific. Thank you for your nice comments to my book.
Oh, yeah. Sure, you got it.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken...